It's your friendly stranger, John Cannell, here once again with yet another informative and stimulating interview. Our special guest for today is Greg Felton. Mr. Felton holds a bachelor's degree in Russian studies and a master's in political science from the University of British Columbia. He is an investigative reporter and a columnist on politics and the media, with his international columns on the Middle East appearing in the Canadian Arab News, MediaMonitors.net, The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, Akram, and Al Jazeera. He has created some deal of interest with his soon-to-be-published book titled Enemies by Design, Inventing the War on Terrorism. It's an in-depth illustrative work exposing special interest groups who cultivate, then promote, negative depictions of the Muslim world to justify otherwise unjust aggressions against the innocent peoples of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine. So, without further delay, it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Greg Felton. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. John, yourself?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little uneasy with the studio here. I usually have an assistant with me, and today I'm by myself, so hopefully everything will go okay. But yeah, it's a fascinating subject that you're bringing to our attention with your new book. And one of the interesting, it's almost shocking to some, I'm sure, but part of what you've addressed in your book is that there's actually no evidence substantiated that truly links Muslims to the attack of 9/11. And I was hoping you might elaborate a bit more on that.
Well, for example, one of the best pieces of evidence we're told is that the planes from Boston's Logan Airport was hijacked and flown into Tower 1.
Mm-hmm.
However, no equipment at the Boston Airport shows any Muslims getting on the aircraft. No Muslim names appear on the passenger list. And we're supposed to believe that Muhammad Atta and other people bought their tickets with their own credit cards.
Mm.
And there seems to be a lot of unanswered questions and contradictory information, such that one is reasonably allowed to believe that what we are told is not true. And in fact, the entire September the 11th attack was so elaborate and so well coordinated that it is probably beyond the capabilities of any so-called Muslim terrorist groups. This was a very organized, very sophisticated operation, and it is hard to believe that Muslims with a few, you know, razor knives got on board aircraft and flew them into these buildings. It's not credible. In fact, the Pentagon plane, the American Airlines Flight 11, that simply wasn't possible. That did not happen.
Hmm. What was it in particular regarding Flight 11 that was?
Well, that particular one was, there was no wreckage. There were materials in front of the building, such as fiber cable spools, that were utterly undamaged. Neighboring parts of the air building neck adjacent to the impact site were undamaged. In fact, the entire face of the Pentagon that was hit is inconsistent with the impact of a Boeing 757 or a 767. Mm-hmm. It is, however, consistent with that of a cruise missile, which would leave such a very narrow, deep hole within the Pentagon. Now, I don't want to get too deeply into this.
Yeah, well, I know.
All part of the book, but in fact, nobody has adduced any evidence that a Muslim was responsible for this attack. It's everything that we know about this comes from sources that have a vested interest in making Muslims look as horrible as possible. And this is the basic reason why I'm writing this book, is to debunk a lot of the negative stereotyping that has infected our minds and has turned us against Muslims.
Right. Well, as it was so reported by MSNBC's Jim Mikulishvili, yes, right, sorry. That's right, Mikulishvili. I mean, he told us that he has these presidential directive documents outlining a strategy to invade Afghanistan specifically, and they're dated September 9th, 2001. So I can see what you're saying. They want to demonize Afghanistan to some degree anyway as a part of a strategy that existed prior to 9/11.
Well,
so they're already set up to do what you're saying.
And also, if you look at the behavior of the United States government after the arrival of George W. Bush, Bush essentially dropped any attempt by the previous administration to capture bin Laden. In fact, the United States went out of its way to play footsie with the Taliban to coerce, cajole, wheedle, and bribe them into allowing trans-Afghanistani pipeline access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the time, let's not forget that the United States wanted to put a pipeline from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan into Pakistan and from there to the Indian Ocean.
Right, right.
Because they wanted to tap the great Jalal-Tibet oil field,
mm-hmm.
just next to Uzbekistan. Unfortunately, the Taliban had a prior deal with Bright Apple for Argentina, and they would not go back on that deal.
Right.
The United States wouldn't take no for an answer, so they put tremendous pressure on them, and there was a meeting in Berlin in August of 2001 where they said, essentially, you will either allow us to put our pipeline across, or we'll bomb you.
Yeah, I believe it was a minister anyway from Pakistan who had quoted one of the people at that meeting who said that the threat was that they would bomb their country.
Yeah, a carpet of gold or a carpet of bomb.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, exactly. So they were friends with the Taliban, tried to cozy up to them, giving them even cash, too. I think there was like $43 million they'd given to them. They actually congratulated them for eradicating the heroin trade, and that was one of the reasons why that money was given to them, and so it was said. And as soon as they lost an opportunity to cajole them into accepting a contract from Enron is one of the members of that consortium, as soon as the Taliban said, we're not going to take your offer, that's when they turned the wheels against them, right? They gave this threat, and then, like I say, and you're aware, too, I mean, MSNBC has reported that they put together a strategy to invade Afghanistan. And, boy, what a pretext 9/11 turned out to be for them. I guess they would have us think that that was all just a coincidence, I suppose.
What's really interesting is that Rumsfeld, soon after the attack on Afghanistan, at least the attack on September the 11th, had no intention or no desire to go into Afghanistan because there were no useful targets.
Yeah.
He wanted to bomb Iraq.
Right.
And that really is much of the book, as to why they wanted to bomb Iraq within minutes, within hours
mm-hmm.
of September the 11th attacks. Now, why would they want to bomb Iraq, which at that time had no link at all to the event?
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of Rumsfeld's request, as it was reported, was he said, find anything and all things, anything to connect to Iraq, anything. Like, he seems he's a little bit more familiar with the nature of truth and deception, and that you just reach out and try to find something that we can connect Saddam to this terrorist act. And I think I know why. One of the reasons is their strategy was to use no evidence in allegations against bin Laden. It's phenomenally interesting from my perspective, and I'm sure a lot of other people would be interested also to learn that their strategy is to not use any evidence as a guaranteed prerequisite to, as you say, gain access into Afghanistan. Whether bin Laden did it or not, I mean, if they use no evidence, bin Laden will plead not guilty. The Taliban will support his defense because they're fundamentalists. They don't want to prosecute the innocent.
Yeah, but there's one thing to remember, though, is that the attack on Afghanistan, however, is not part of the war on terrorism. Because that was in play long before September the 11th had happened. What happened after that, the bombing of Afghanistan, was essentially a religious, visceral hatred of Muslims. That was, we're going to go bomb you because we got to take our anger out on somebody.
Mm, yeah, there's that for sure. Right?
And the war on terrorism, so-called, this horrible expression that Ronald Reagan cooked up just after the Iran hostage crisis. But the war on terrorism, so-called, refers to the bombing of Iraq and the general repression of Muslims around the world, even in the United States itself.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan must be separated from these. There is a connection. There is a peripheral one, but it's not really central to the argument. And this is something my book does point out very clearly. Because people who look at Iraq and say, oh, well, they're in there for the oil fields. They're in there to get control of the oil. There is a connection in their minds between what happened in Afghanistan and what went on in Iraq, but there is no connection there. These are two entirely separate events brought about by the same people, but with different objectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, in both objectives, so they, like the thing about people talking about getting strategic control of the oil, well, that might be part of it, but I mean, all the billions and billions and billions of dollars we've watched move have gone through the criminal enterprise itself. I mean, it's all these, it's the looting of the Iraq development funds, like all the money that was in the possession of the Iraqi government, Bush just claimed sole ownership of, and that's all called theft in my world and in everybody else's, but people just aren't so familiar, they don't really, you know, that's his opinion. Well, no, how do you figure Bush earned his right to take possession of all Iraqi assets? Not only the oil, but everything else. And,
but again, you're making an economic argument. The
right.
whole point of getting into Iraq was economic.
Right.
But there's
yeah.
evidence to suggest that that is not true. It is categorically irrational for the United States to bomb Iraq into oblivion, torture and hideously, cruelly treat the Iraqi people,
mm-hmm.
lie and completely destroy their international reputation, send their own soldiers to die meaningless deaths in the desert. I mean, there is not one good thing that has come out of this for the United States. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted oil that badly, they would have found some way to do a deal with Saddam Hussein. Let's face it, the United States has done deals with worse people mm-hmm. than Hussein.
Yeah, but
Pinochet, Suharto, Noriega, Marcos. What made Saddam Hussein so particularly heinous? Well, nothing particularly.
Well, he was moving his market into the euro. That's one thing. But it's also
but so is Russia.
Yeah, but it's also important to recognize, too, like Halliburton can't take the billions and billions of dollars they have taken so far unless they indiscriminately murder the people there. Like, I mean, that's the thing. With the inspectors, they had complete access. But if they just let the inspectors do their job, you know, all the military-industrial complex isn't going to be able to take all that cash. So they make money off the chaos. So that's why you get Cheney so supportive of the war now. It's like, yeah, his buddies are cashing, and, you know, they'll meet him for dinner or whatever. You know,
yeah, don't forget,
let's not be naive.
Yeah, but in 1991, Cheney said that no government that the United States imposed on Iraq would be recognized. It would create fissions and civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. He actually had nothing good to say about it at all. I mean, essentially what Cheney predicted in 1991... the consequences he foresaw of invasion, bombing, and total subjugation of Iraq have borne fruit. He was absolutely accurate as the defense secretary. As a vice president, he has come full circle and lied through his teeth time and again to justify the indefensible. Now, we cannot look to an economic motive for this, because the economic motives and the consequences of brutality were well known. We have to look for some other reason. And that other reason has to do with Israel. And this is one of the main thesis of my book, is that the United States has committed acts of unspeakable brutality in Iraq, not because they want the oil, not because they want to pillage the country down to its last oil well, although that is part of it, but principally because Israel wanted to destroy the center of Arab learning and the great public supporter of the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein was almost unique among Persian Gulf leaders in that he was not afraid to take on Israel, if rhetorically, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. But I just want to get back to what you're saying about Israel. They too can earn money off of creating instability by them victimizing the innocent. Brings about another reason for Ariel Sharon to ask for more financial assistance from the American people.
But don't forget, Israel does know that it's pushing its luck. It knows that it has really lost the war for propaganda, that
and
it only exists because of its Maginot line of subservient media outlets that are doing its best to prop up the crumbling dike that's holding back the water of world indignation.
Yeah, and Jewish indignation too. It's
exactly.
Interesting. Yeah,
these are
like
some of the greatest victims of the Zionists.
Oh, I'm totally in agreement with you on that. That's for certain. Yeah, I feel that Ariel Sharon isn't even Jewish. I've argued that he isn't Jewish.
Well,
how do you figure he's Jewish?
His parents were Polish, and they came. And he was actually born it was Bethlehem or Jerusalem, but he was actually born there. But his parents are Polish.
Hmm.
I mean, he's a Slav. He's not even Middle Eastern.
Hmm. Yeah, and
this was with all the Ashkenazi. I mean, they're not. I mean, their role in forming Israel had nothing to do with religion. It was purely political.
Right, but
secular Jews, and they actually can look down and treated with contempt the common Yiddisher Jews, the believing Jews who wanted to live in Europe and become good members of European society. Mm-hmm. Because the Bible says that, you know, wherever Jews are, they should obey the laws of the land and treat everybody with justice.
Right, and that's why he wouldn't be found to be an honest Jewish person, because you have all people are created in God's image, and you don't want to do something to someone else that you wouldn't want to be done to yourself. I mean, you're victimizing who again? An innocent person. You say they haven't committed any criminal offense, but just because they're Christians, let's say, they're Christian Palestinians, you have some right by might, by American firepower, actually, to steal this person's home and essentially throw them into a concentration camp, you know, and some of these places are very much reminiscent.
Of course they are.
And I think that truth is very difficult for some people to deal with. Like, all people have problems with identity. Like, we, you know, not it's not only a Jewish thing. This is part of what all young adults go through, I suppose.
This is why the Holocaust is such a very dangerous thing to talk about, because it's not really understood. It's preached at us like a sermon. We're supposed to accept at face value what we're told about it, as if to criticize it is somehow disrespectful.
Yeah.
And much of what we know about the Holocaust has been propagated by the Zionists and can be shown to be quite untrue. I don't want to get into a long, detailed argument about this. It's not the purpose of this interview.
Well, the thing is we do know, like, one thing about the whole situation is that innocent people were targeted for murder. End of story. I mean, that's what the war was. I mean, all wars are like that. So it's hard to...
As a matter of fact, Lord Yehudi Menuhin, the famed violinist, told Le Figaro that he saw a direct parallel between Israel and Nazi Germany. And Jews will come out and they will make the connection between Nazi Germany and Israel. As a matter of fact, the Zionists who built Israel were Nazi collaborators. This goes back particularly to Yitzhak Shamir, who wanted to form an alliance with Hitler against the British. So the people who formed Israel were not really interested in forming a Jewish state. They were interested in forming an expansionist imperial state, that they were going to recreate the historic biblical kingdom of Israel. But religion was really not the driving force, because Ben-Gurion was a secular Jew, so was Heinz Eisenman. I mean, as I said, the religious believing Jews who wanted to live according to traditional Mosaic law and so forth and live in Europe peaceably, these were not welcome, and they were shunned, they were marginalized. And this is one of the few things that people don't understand about Israel. It is not a Jewish state. It never has been. It is a ethnocentric garrison state that adheres to the same master race mentality as did Hitler's Nazi Germany. And when you look at Iraq and the brutality and the kind of brutality that America is inflicting on the Iraqis, you see a direct parallel to the kind of brutality that the Israelis inflict on the Palestinians.
And Hitler inflicted on our world.
And the Jews, that's right. Yeah. And this is why you have to look beyond the economic argument, which, however relevant it may be, is not the prime reason why America bombed Iraq. It had no reason to. I'd like to read you one little thing I have for my book. This is Dick Cheney. And this is... what he said about the problem of getting rid of Saddam Hussein and the problem of putting another government in place. He said, what kind of government? Should it be a Sunni government or a Shi'i government or a Kurdish government or a Ba'athist regime? Or maybe we want to bring in some of the Islamic fundamentalists. How long would we have to stay in Baghdad to keep that government in place? What would happen to the government once U.S. forces withdrew? How many casualties should the United States accept in that effort to try to create clarity and stability in a situation that is inherently unstable? I think it is vitally important for a president to know when to use military force. I think it is also very important for him to know when not to commit U.S. military force. And it is my view that the president got it right both times. That would have been a mistake for us to get bogged down in the quagmire inside Iraq. Now, can you think of a more brilliant testament to the stupidity of George W. Bush?
Hmm. Well, and it is stupid, and I think, now that you're saying that, I'm thinking, they could be running from 9/11. You know, they'll do anything and everything to try to create fear within our societies to somehow stop true justice from prevailing in arresting, like, let's say, General Ahmad. You know, he's a... But they are creating a lot of fear.
Well, the fear is necessary for two reasons, and the principal reason for fear has nothing to do with Iraq. It has to do with the government itself. The Bush government is criminal.
Right.
There should be a Nuremberg trial set up to try everybody from George Bush to Condoleezza Rice,
absolutely,
Rumsfeld, Fife, everybody.
Right.
Both of it.
Exactly.
Now, the problem is, how do you keep people from paying attention to this? You keep them focused on an external enemy. You keep them thinking about the great enemy within, the other. And so they foment this fascistic hatred of a definable group of people.
Yeah.
And so the war on terrorism, so-called, is not so much a way for the United States to protect itself against its enemies. It is a way for it to create enemies.
Mm-hmm.
To justify the kind of repressive measures that would otherwise be intolerable during peacetime.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
And that's why these are enemies by design. Muslims are necessary for the United States because it fits into the quasi-religious, demented mindset of a country that needs to have an enemy to feed a military-industrial complex that is so out of control it might as well be a rival country. The very thing that Dwight Eisenhower warned against in his farewell address in 1960, just before Jack Kennedy took office, or before Jack Kennedy was elected. This was Dwight Eisenhower's great prescient assessment of the failure of the United States to understand the limitations of its power. We cannot allow, we are in a position now where we have a great industrial complex designed to turn out military equipment, but we don't want that to overburden our economy, to make it disproportionately military. We have to be careful of the military industrial complex pushing our economy onto a perpetual war footing. But without a perpetual war footing, you can't justify the Republican Party's existence, because Ronald Reagan came to power in 1980 because of the neocon economists, and they're the ones that made it possible for the Christians, particularly the Jews, to get into government and to contort the American administrations into serving Israel. And if you look at what happened with Ronald Reagan's government and the people who were involved in the Arms for Hostages scandal, in the Contra scandal, these are the same people that would now crop up in George W. Bush's government.
Matter of fact, one last thing here.
It's interesting to note that Vice President Bush referred to these people, Paul Wolfowitz, Michael Ledeen, Richard Perle, Frank Gaffney, and a whole bunch of other people. He referred to them as the crazies.
Yeah.
Because they were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He kept them at bay. He wanted nothing to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
See, Bush was a moderate. His son is I don't know what he is, but he's not moderate.
No, he's lawless completely. You know, he's used no evidence to back up his allegations. But I just want to say, like, we've fallen into the trap ourselves, I think. You know, when we refer to Paul Wolfowitz and all these guys as Jews, we forget that that's not what a Jew is, and that's the thing.
These are the Zionist Jews.
Yeah, well, I mean, that can be difficult. I mean, even Zionism has a positive reflection within biblical texts and is not connotated to the neocons. See, neocon, I know right away who they are. Like, neocon, I know right away. It's not from my perspective, it's not really a religious thing. It is.
Neocon economists, it's not based in rational analysis of economics.
Right, exactly. But that doesn't connotate that they're referring to some biblical text or some.
It doesn't matter. But you see, religion does not have to be ecclesiastical.
Okay.
The religious mindset can appeal.
Yeah, it's a faith.
Yeah, but it's a dogmatic belief system in which reason and logic play little or no role.
Right. Yes. And so, but so it is through their power of influence and suggestion that would have other people join their mantle to say, we want a regressive tax system, like you're saying, with reason and understanding. There's a progressive tax system, or there's a regressive tax system, which a neocon will always advocate, which is an act of destruction. You're killing yourself. But people go, oh, no, it's just your opinion. And those who say it's just my opinion are those who don't understand. You know, you're taking money from poor people and putting it all into the hands of the wealthy, and they're not doing anything for you, and the economy is being drained. I mean, you want to keep some levels of balance in where government is taking their money that they're going to in turn spend. And it becomes a difficult thing to communicate because it takes time. People got to work it out.
What's pernicious about that is that to the uninformed, it sounds logical. I have a major chapter in my book that's a little heavy going, but it's necessary. It analyzes for lack of a better word, the illogic behind neocon economics and what it truly is. And I go back to Leo Strauss, who is the intellectual progenitor of neocon economics, and it was he who influenced, who taught, actually, Paul Wolfowitz, I think it was in Chicago. And it was Leo Strauss who gave a whole generation of economists a pseudo-intellectual foundation upon which they could build the most atrocious philosophies and theories, essentially an unenlightened selfishness by which they could justify lower taxes because, hey, who likes to pay taxes? Mm. But they don't argue that taxes are necessary to provide for public goods.
Right. Police services.
It was Edmund Burke who said, government is a human contrivance to meet public wants. Because we need to have things done for us, whether it's medical care, defense, postal service, maintenance of this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
Governments do have a function. But in the United States, government is almost demonized because anything that interferes with the absolute right of the individual to do anything he wants is seen to be a virtual sin against God. And the radical individualism that permeates much of biblical America has an affinity for this kind of thinking. So right away, you have this common perspective between the neocons and the Christians. And you have people like Paul Weyrich, who really started the ball rolling for the theocratization of American politics. I mean, he was the one who founded the Heritage Foundation, the first real political think tank of the began the 1970s. There had been others around, but this was a major one that started the think tank industry going full tilt. And it was the Heritage Foundation that put Ronald Reagan into office. 11 people from Heritage were put into his administration, and he was not the president of the United States. He was a mouthpiece for Heritage. Let's face it. Paul Weyrich and Jerry Falwell and all these people saw in the neocons the sort of selfishness and arrogance that they brought to religion. And all they needed... Elitism in its own way is not necessarily bad, because we're all elitists in some way. But in a governmental sense, and this is what Leo Strauss taught, the governments have an obligation to keep from the public things they don't want the public to know, to tell the public only what they want it to know, and to use religion instrumentally to keep the public in line.
Yeah, like a government of traitors is their official dogma. We want to screw people over and lie to them. And in fact, are you familiar with the recent revelations regarding Rumsfeld and his secret army?
Oh, yeah.
You heard about, it's again this naked treason kind of thing, like we had with Bush and torture. He says, I'm totally against torture, but we have these presidential directive documents saying you it's okay. And then you have the memo from Gonzalez says, the strategy is you're going to argue with us about the definition of torture. You're going to tell us you don't support it, but you're going to say it's okay behind closed doors. And now if we confront you publicly and pull your demon carcass into the light, you're going to argue with us about the definition. So now we got Rumsfeld. He's got his own, he wants to get a private military going. But the thing about it is they don't want to be accountable to the people because they're going to be doing things illegal.
But this is precisely, this goes to the heart, because Leo Strauss believed that for a government to be accountable to the public and to formulate policies that served the public was a betrayal of the very philosophical principles that made Western society great.
You've been listening to an interview with Greg Felton, author of Enemies by Design, Inventing the War on Terrorism. If you want to hear this full interview in its entirety, feel free to get yourself to the internet. Go to Google and put World Productions in quotes, and throw Indie Media in there and you'll be able to find it. Continue further with our discussions. Have a great day, people. Look forward, though, to another fantastic broadcast coming your way very shortly.
The truth is out there.
Also, I think people are so pressed for time, just trying to make it. You know, whether they're trying to get that carrot on a stick that they're never going to get. You know, gotta pay my mortgage. Gotta pay off that SUV. Gotta fill my house with more crap that I'm never even going to have enough time to use because I'm too busy working to buy more crap. You know, like our society is so materialistically driven that, you know, we define ourselves by what we own, you know, what we drive, yeah, instead of, you know, who we are in a sense. And I think we're being told who we are by the corporate advertising and
right, and
whatnot.
It's accepted.
And it's accepted, and you're not supposed to think, you know, you just... I mean, that's pretty common kind of...
I think that that's maybe perhaps some of the problems that we might have with the way the corporate news agencies work today. If there was more interaction where we felt as a part of the community, we were interchanging ideas with the national news interests. Like, for example, CBC, you know, their news coverage is far superior to anything that comes out of American television networks. But
C-SPAN is good, too.
Okay, States. Yeah, and yeah. I don't get a chance to see that much so. But my point is with CBC, they have a 1-800 number where people can comment on the programs. And as an individual, if I phone that number and I say, well, look, Bush's business partner, General Ahmad... This is according to the FBI, and you can follow this up for yourself. But Bush's business partner, General Ahmad, funded the mastermind ringleader, Muhammad Atta. You know, if you guys would like me to make a public comment or whatever, I'd be happy to do that. I just feel you're doing an injustice for our community when you silently allow Bush supporters to tell us about how evil Afghanistan is, while the true perpetrator who funded the mastermind ringleader is walking away with Bush as his buddy. And people go, yeah, well, that's just your opinion. Well, no, actually, that's the FBI's opinion. But my point is, of course, my voice goes silent. So at home, I'm watching TV, I go, oh, they're not voicing any of my objections. Oh, well, I guess it's too radical. But the thing that I notice is they don't voice anybody's objections, anybody's ideas. You know, you'd think with a country as big as Canada, there's got to be some bitchers and complainers out there. And there's likely going to be some people like myself that are going to offer some relevant, hugely relevant information regarding America's largest terrorist attack of history. But there is nothing. So I see that there's two potentials there. There's a potential for me to feel all alone and isolated. Or, two, at the same time, to recognize that all people could feel that way. And instead of us all feeling ostracized from the public arena, in fact, that could be a nature to our suffering. That because there isn't an open exchange, we can be made to feel powerless, and yet 99.9% of the public could be well aware that Bush not only was working with the guy who funded the mastermind ringleader, but him, Condoleezza Rice, and Rumsfeld put together a top-secret presidential directive strategy, as reported on by Jim McGlueshky at MSNBC News, a strategy to invade Afghanistan, dated September 9th, 2001. You know, when Dynak, you know, when I heard of this, I figured, well, I better call CBC. They're going to want to cover this.
Right.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what, people? They didn't talk about it.
Well, one thing about CBC I find interesting is there is some good things that do get out. There was one thing they did on 9/11 that I thought was interesting. That was the Fifth Estate. They had Mike Rupert on.
Really?
And yeah, it was, you know, it was basically about, you know, prior knowledge and what, you know. They didn't really go into the whole Pakistani connection, and mm-hmm. they just talked to this one French guy who wrote a book that was quite popular, and I can't remember his name. I'm sorry, but you know, that got out. That was great, and that was prior to you know, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 film. So that I thought was interesting. But by and large, yeah, I don't think they're quite ready to take the you know.
But and yet at the same time, they'll sell that image. Like every news broadcast they have, they stress.
We're so liberal and we'll tell you all you need to know.
Here's the number. Only do they give you a contact number, it's a 1-800 number. How easy is that for anyone across Canada to participate? So I can imagine whoever's running that, you know, that answering machine service there, that's where true liberation for our communities can be found. Like I've suggested, just put all the tips and all the stuff they get through their telephone on the internet at least. Say, look, this is all the stuff we got. We're ignoring.
Yeah, well, they have a filter and they have interests and they have, yeah.
Yeah, because that same relationship when it comes
like
to
any of them, so.
Yeah, the same relationship that when it comes to who perpetrated 9/11 and who's getting away with it so far. By not being arrested or hunted down by the American military and tried publicly, give them a chance to defend themselves and then executed for those criminal offenses. Not only are we not having those demands of liberation at least talked about, but we're in that same relationship. We have the Iraq War now, you know, and the Iraq War, to the shock of some people, and you can't blame people. We're all affected by suggestion to one degree or another. Nobody's absolutely certain about anything. So we have to, there's an implicit trust that we have in our corporate magic TVs that, you know, they are going to convey some important information and they're going to be half honest most of the time. But in the case of Iraq, we know if anybody has access, as I'm sure many do, to the internet, we know that there are plenty of voices that used rational thinking and arguments to say, there's no reason to go into Iraq as a military conflict because we have complete access as it is. What is it that you want to bring about for these people in Iraq, or what interest do you want to serve for the Bush administration? Because you can do anything but thieve right now. Like, you can go into Iraq, look wherever you want. They were in the palaces, they're under the coops. No delay, without restrictions. This was March 7, 2003.
Meanwhile, their art gallery there is... you know, 1,000-year-old artifacts are being pillaged and destroyed and robbed.
Yeah.
And what's their priority? They secure the oil fields right away. So.
Right. And by CBC and all the corporate interests, the newspapers, you know, the newspapers, and I've argued with malicious criminal intent because I've talked to these people.
Good for business, bad for people.
It depends on who you are. But, yeah, bad for people, exactly. They're interested in their private profit margins. What way can they best exploit the situation to bring in more coffers for themselves? So why put money into research, as CNN just keeps telling us all about? You know, they have all these guys there that they actually pay. I'm sure they're getting $50,000, maybe even $150,000 as almost a payoff to pretend you're a researcher, and yet they put no time into these jobs at all, practically. We had, you know, Fallujah? You know, the nearest death estimate I can make is, you know, exceeding 200,000 people. They forbid anybody from leaving the city, 15 to 50. They didn't tell the people who lived in the city that they were going to flatten it with 9 2,000-pound bombs, napalm, cluster dud munitions, using depleted uranium bullets to riddle every apartment block and house they could come across. You know, they've essentially murdered 200,000 people, you know, and are these not the crimes of evil? Are these, as Bush would claim?
Well, they're fighting evil with good, you see. You see that the rationale there.
Well,
you
know, so it's interesting because it's so much opposite to what Bush tells America to believe. You know, especially...
Well, you know, Bush, you know, like, he's obviously a puppet, and everyone knows that, but... It's not, maybe, I mean, as a president, we all know, you know, politicians are corrupt, so I wouldn't even expect them to tell the truth. But there has to be a certain amount of accountability when the news reports, you know, your job as the nervous system of a democracy is the free press, you know, to keep things like this from not happening, and so that people get informed so they can make the proper decisions and not just have this huge right-wing neocon echo chamber blaring in your head, you know, like the stuff that comes out of Bill O'Reilly's mouth is...
Oh, God,
It's
Rush Limbaugh, too.
It's surreal. It's not even... there's no words to describe that.
Yeah, like I was listening to Coast to Coast last night, and, you know, God, George Norrie, you know, he's done a couple of shows that were half-decent over the last couple of years. But last night, man, he goes on and on about how the soldiers are dying for freedom. and they're just lies. You know, what is freedom without justice? You know, the Bush administration, like you were saying earlier about him being a puppet, you know, I don't necessarily follow that. Although I can see how people could view him in such light. But I take one of his quotes: people routinely misunderestimate himself. And I think there are two issues that just popped to my mind right now. He knows, Bush knows, he signed that top secret presidential directive document to invade Afghanistan on September 9th, 2001. He knows he signed that document, and he knows that the whole strategy behind invasion is to blame bin Laden as a terrorist but provide zero evidence to back up the allegation. This way, whether bin Laden did 9/11 or otherwise, he's going to get into Afghanistan, which is his objective.
Well, they've wanted to do that all along for the pipeline.
Yeah, the very last thing that President Bush wanted was to actually arrest bin Laden. Now, that's their military strategy. Now, you try to convince other people of it. It requires, you know, like you're saying, 60% of the people or 20, whatever. You hope that people would reach out that far, but it's difficult. But then here's something else. So if you're aware of these presidential directive documents that were reported on by Jim Mikulski, you begin to see George Bush in a different light. And then there's this one. This is a recent thing. You get these situations of torturing innocent people to death. Okay? Now, Bush and Gonzalez, they've repeatedly, oh no, it's against the law in the United States to torture innocent people, so we don't support such conduct.
We'll just do it off soil, of American soil.
Well, you know what? The interesting thing, under American law, is if you torture somebody in another country, you get 25 years. If you torture...
The truth is out there.
Under attack, you know, it's always the rationale. Well, we were attacked. They attacked us.
Yeah.
You know, it's... Well, that... Well, okay, fine, they did, but who are they? What are their connections to the Bush family and et cetera?
Yeah.
You know, and who stands to gain from all of this?
Yeah.
And you see who does. You know, it's the billions of dollars.
At our losses.
At our loss. Their wealth is our poverty, basically.
And as a victimization... Which is why the war is, why we can term the war illegal. The reason that it's illegal is there is actually no rational justification for it. You can't come up with an explanation as to why the country was bombed. I'm sorry. You know, a lot of people have a hard time dealing with that. But then that's the function of justice itself. Like, if Bush could have formulated some reason to bomb the country to begin with, but he didn't. He says, you know, Bush has been quoted saying, Saddam wouldn't let the inspectors in. I swear to God, this is what he says. He's quoted several times saying this. This is why he started the conflict. Now, CBC and CNN and all our corporate interests, if you call them up, they're going to say, well, we can't report it. It's too embarrassing for him. And the fact is that that's not a function of our reality. That's not what truly took place. You know, so this is, again, the function of law. Like, if
too embarrassing.
Yeah, like the war's termed illegal by the UN. Why? Because Saddam wasn't found in violation of 1441, which was the resolution. Now, Scott McClellan there, the spokesman, he lies to America, to your face. You know, like Condoleezza Rice lied to your face when she told you that these aluminum tubes could only be used for uranium enrichment. But the manufacturer says, no, they routinely sell this stuff out to other countries as reverse-engineered rocket canisters. This is something that's ordered by other countries to build rockets with, and that's Saddam's story, and he's got the blueprints, and because it's treated a certain way, it can't be used for nuclear centrifuges.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, Condoleezza Rice took that position to say for sure that's what it was. She wasn't nailed for those lies. Specifically, just on that one alone, you could get her for that, but they don't. And yet...
Well, if you see the... not on that topic, but the basically the prior knowledge... the clip they used of Condoleezza Rice in Fahrenheit 9/11, and if you get the DVD and under like the extras, they show the full testimony in front of the Senate hearings that they had. And I mean, she was like fumbling all over the place, and she got nailed, you know, basically. And that's the basic gist of it. And
like her motivation.
How? What do you do? Like, I mean, okay, people know, but the truth is out about that,
mm-hmm.
you know. where are the mechanisms now for these people to be brought to justice?
Yeah, you know what that's the thing. And we talked about like the torture thing. It is against the law to torture people to death, yet the people are going unarrested. And Bush, he just says, well, we don't like to do torture. Yeah, it's like something he opposes to, but yet we know through these documents and these memos and these agreements that's signed through Rumsfeld that it's okay to drown them. That's not really torturing. And they're completely innocent. We have no evidence against them. So, how is that going to be dealt with?
The language that's used, you know, whatever. They'll just come up with an elaborate word. They won't say torture. Yeah, they'll just say information withdrawal. Something like that. All these terms.
No, you got it exactly right. Gonzalez in the memo there, he talks about the fact that we can argue about the definition.
Orwell. Yeah.
Yeah, we can argue about the definition forever. We'll torture innocent people to death, Bushy buddy. And if somebody asks us, just say we oppose it because it is against the law, but we'll still do it. And if push comes to shove, we will argue it forever. Don't worry about it. You're the leader of the free world. Let's go get some cash.
The truth is out there.
That you yourself have created. You know, create the fear, create the, you know, Saddam, whatever. You know, he's been a business partner of the Americans way back. This is no new news.
When he was the bad guy, when he committed
his worst atrocities, he was on the payroll of the American government. So now you have this problem, okay? Oh, well, now we got to get rid of them, you know? What's the solution? Well, you know...
Yeah, like I've said before, if Bush actually had some grievance with Saddam, why doesn't he bring forward that evidence? And then we could publicly try Saddam. But you know what? He doesn't do that. You know why that is? Because, hey...
Well, they're all guilty, that's why.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting. Although it requires, several hours of show, and we could get into the details. So I don't really want to go there without having to cover the facts so people can, better trust my word to be so. But, just as an example, Bush keeps saying Saddam gasses his own people, or did when Rumsfeld gave him full support after he had so-called committed these atrocities. Yeah. That's when Rumsfeld was shaking in his hand saying, way to go, buddy. But at that time, these people were killed by a cyanide-based blood agent, and Saddam has only been known to use mustard gas, and they have the records of his weapons development during that time.
Yeah, I don't really know the full details.
Well, the cyanide-based blood agent was what Iran was using in that war at that time. Like, Iraq and Iran were at war. And this is where they say Saddam gassed his own people. But those people died by a cyanide-based blood agent that Iran was using in that conflict. No good guys, really. I mean, all war is bad news, okay? But the cyanide-based blood agent was sold to Iran from Israel. So there's an example. There's just one of all the examples, I'm sure, would come to the somewhat similar conclusions, where if you follow the actual evidence that Bush accuses without doing so, you find, things aren't necessarily...
On January 7th, 2005, 40-year-old Sergeant Kevin Benjamin refused an order from his command sergeant major to redeploy to Iraq and then requested a court-martial. Benderman is a combat veteran with the 27th Infantry Battalion at Fort Stewart, Georgia. He served in Iraq in 2003. During his tour, his outfit was ordered to open fire on children who were throwing rocks at unit personnel. Having personally witnessed this and other illegal acts by military personnel, Benderman has said publicly that under no circumstances will he participate further in the war in Iraq, a war that Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has labeled illegal. He has applied for conscientious objector status. This story was brought to light by Robert S. Finnegan, managing editor of the Southeast Asian News. John Cannell has been studying the Bush administration activities since before 9/11. He reached Sergeant Benderman and his wife Monica in their home in Fort Stewart, Georgia on January 14th.
I understand, Kevin, that you're stationed with the 27th Infantry Battalion of Fort Stewart, Georgia.
Yes, right now I'm a member of the rear detachment of 27th Infantry.
Okay, and you had already served, you'd already gone to Iraq once already.
Yes, I served from March to September of 2003.
Okay, and then you've come back to America, and you've been asked, your unit has been asked to once again go to Iraq and participate in this conflict. And from what is being reported, of course, you've said you don't want to go.
I have applied for the conscientious objector status, and I have refused deployment.
Okay, and it's interesting too. From my perspective, it seems that really the Army couldn't have a position against yours because, of course, the war has been declared illegal by the UN, and also some of the criticisms that we've had against the American media is that, you know, the war itself didn't seem to be justified because prior to the conflict beginning, the Bush administration, or the United States of America, if you will, had complete access to go wherever they pleased without delay. In fact, the last report from the UN, I think it was March the 7th, just prior to the conflict starting up, was stating that specifically, that they could go wherever you wanted without delay, without restrictions. They were in the process of doing flyovers, and it just seemed like a very unjustified war to begin with. And I figure I can't see how they could ever take a position against yours, being that the war itself has been declared unjustified. And why are you there anyway? Are some of those questions being asked by some of your fellow soldiers? Have you heard other people talking about really what the function, like really what are you guys doing there besides, so some believe you're trying to free these people or bring democracy, but are there many soldiers that you know of questioning the reasoning behind the behavior of the military in its totality?
Like, well, I can't answer that question. All I can answer is for myself, and I have come to the conclusion that all war is wrong. So therefore, I cannot participate in any war.
I did actually read a quote that you had. Somebody had criticized you. I think it was on WSAV-TV out of Savannah, and I think it was Carol. She had said, oh, you were a coward. And you had said, your quote was, but doesn't she think, as a military spouse, that it would be better for her husband if we could settle our differences without going to war? And I think you're right on the button there. Like, I mean, if you've, you know, the idea of this conflict, if it truly has no justification, nobody can actually form a reason for why we're there. Like, I mean, one of the things I've heard is since we had unrestricted access and the inspectors were free to go wherever they pleased, if you had to send soldiers in there, you could have sent them in unarmed. They could have joined the inspection force because they were free to go wherever they wanted. No bombs were needed to be dropped or children being shot, which is part of, I think, your story, which is, you know, it's good in its terrible way, but part of your complaint is that you were a witness to and perhaps played a part in what you felt were truly crimes against the innocent. And
well, if you stop to think about it, all war is crime against humanity because of the very nature of the beast.
Right.
And not just this war, but it was all the previous wars that have ever been fought and all the other wars that someone may think of fighting in the future.
Yeah.
War is war no matter where it is.
I think I can speak a little bit to the question of, I think it was Carolyn actually that called and voiced her comments about Kevin yesterday.
Okay.
And as a spouse, I can say that, you know, I'm proud of the fact that Kevin was willing to serve for his country and the reasons that he felt the need to serve his country. But I'm also proud of the fact now that he says, you know what, as I've seen and I can tell from firsthand experience that, one, killing innocent people, killing people in general, you know, the whole concept of violence as a way to solve our problems is wrong. I see that, and I respect that. And then I also speak as a wife. I watched him agonize coming back from Iraq, and the things that he'd seen, he hadn't had to kill somebody, but he saw what killing people had done and what the bombing had done, and that tore him up. Now, if he were to go to war and be put into a place where he was responsible for killing somebody, I can't imagine, one, what that would have done for the rest of his life to have to live with that knowledge. And I, for one, support him in saying I can't do that, because to support anything and say, you know, you're a coward if you don't go to war and, you know, you're a hero if you go to war, I'm sorry. I think the agony of putting somebody in that position and then living the rest of their life knowing what they were responsible for is worse. And
yeah, well, no, I agree with you, and I think most people would too. I mean, if they got some time to think it through, and I can't see how he could be labeled a coward. It reminds me of those who say, or those who would criticize the decisions of the Bush administration, do not support the troops. You know, like, I mean, if you can save American military personnel from going into a needless conflict and dying for no better good, I mean, you're the true patriot. I mean, if they're being put into a position where they're asked to sacrifice their lives, and truly no better good is happening because of that relationship. Like, they'll say they're bringing democracy, but I mean, if we're bringing democracy, surely theft would be outlawed. And I know most soldiers aren't there to steal nothing, but we see, you know, the Iraq Development Fund, billions of dollars have gone missing. Oh, well, you know, I mean, if they're there to bring democracy, they should, if the military position of George Bush and his administration was legitimate and honest and true, they would be calling for those missing dollars. They'd get a criminal investigation going. Instead, we got to wait until democracy arrives, when they should be fighting, you'd figure, for those principles as we understand them today. You know, another thing is, you know, thou shalt not murder, or don't murder. That's another law that's very popular among democracies. And I know in military, as Kevin was saying, in war, there are people that get killed, and that's what it is. But
wouldn't it be more of a tribute to the people that have died in how many wars have we had, when you think of the thousands and thousands of people that have died for, you know, defending the Constitution of America? Wouldn't it be a greater tribute for a soldier to stand up and say, I'm not going to cause another death, that the reason these people died is so we could find a way other than war?
Oh, for sure.
You know, and that, to me, would be the tribute to the people that have died, including those 1,300-plus soldiers that have died in this war. Why should one more person die because we've already lost 1,300?
Yeah, well,
I think what he's trying to say is all the veterans from all the previous wars that have been fought are not fighting. They didn't fight their wars for us to continue war.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially,
and my point on it is that why can't we leave war in the history where it belongs, just like human sacrifice was, just like slavery was? I mean, we had these institutions in our life at one time,
mm-hmm.
until people stood up and said, hey, this is wrong. So when are we going to realize that as the human race, that war is wrong? It's a waste of human energy. It's a waste of human life. It's a waste of our resources. It destroys the planet. It is just wrong all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. You think about it. I've thought about this a lot, being that this is a subject I quite readily talk about on this station. But I mean, as it often occurs to me, I mean, who would disagree with us, Kevin? You know, who is it that really wants to start these conflicts? You can see that in the case of Hitler during World War II, I mean, he was committing indiscriminate acts of murder in nations that were falling undefended. People had to take action to stop an aggressive military force that was committing, atrocity after atrocity. So people, they just had to get up and defend themselves. In this case, it's almost as if some of those same failures of communication within the American culture have brought the military. Not, you know, there's no gas chambers, thank God. But, I mean, we should have been able to address this issue without having to start the conflict and put these soldiers' lives in jeopardy. And you might be familiar with this. You were talking about 1,300 soldiers' deaths. But it has been revealed several times through different news reports that the Pentagon has been misleading the American public when it comes to those who are wounded anyway. I mean, we have reports from the hospital out of Germany that says that they've treated more than 20,000 seriously wounded soldiers, and yet the position from the Pentagon, I think the last report is somewhere around 10,000. So you're wondering, you know, why are they doing that? And I mean, is that a service to the American soldier to have them even misled in that way? And
I can't really answer that question because I don't have access to the data that they've covered on injured soldiers.
Right.
My point again, I have to go back to this.
Sure.
If we could go and figure a way to handle our differences other than with destructive force, I sincerely believe that would be better for humanity in this day and age.
Oh, for sure. But how do we do that? How can we defeat a political force that goes practically unchallenged in the media? I know there are a lot of oppositional forces to the position to go to war before it even happened, and yet from Canada we could notice that very little of it was being discussed in corporate professional circles, and that doesn't seem to be quite a service to the American soldier. And yet those same voices will say, if you say anything else, you don't support our troops. And it's interesting, I didn't get a chance to talk to you before this interview, but I've talked to a Doug Rocky. Are you familiar with Doug Rocky at all, Kevin?
No, I do not know.
Well, he was originally appointed the authority on depleted uranium munitions by Schwarzkopf during the Gulf War I, and he's got a master's in science, and his credentials go on and on, and I don't have them on the top of my head. But he was the foremost authority. He headed up the Army's decontamination units for depleted uranium munitions, and we've had him here on the program. And boy, oh boy, as a scientist, he'll tell you, you know, as soldiers aren't being told that this munition is actually radioactive and oxidizes to microscopic particles and will mutate your cells and give you cancer. And I was wondering, Kevin, if you, as a soldier, were warned that, you know, you have to take some precautions when you're near this form of munition. Are you familiar with the hazards of depleted uranium?
Well, I've read a little bit about depleted uranium. And yes, that's an atomic type substance. So,
right.
As long as atomic substances have been out there, we all know that they are harmful to, you know, a human body.
Yeah.
But let me go back to a question you asked a while ago. You wanted to know what we could do to be able to stop war.
Yeah.
In spite of all the politics that goes on in the world, you and I are going to have to open up dialogue. And when I say you and I mean the average citizens of the countries that are out there, the people in America, the people in Iraq, the people in Canada, the people in France, the people in whatever country that is out there, we're going to have to open up a dialogue amongst ourselves as people, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to stop worrying about political machines. We're going to reach across the table and offer a hand and say, we need to figure out a way to conduct ourselves like intelligent people. And here it is, 2005. We need to do away with the whole concept of war.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually Rocky says, articulates that in his own way, but says the same thing. There is a time that has to come where we can communicate well enough to say, hey, we don't need this war. Let's just talk it through. Does somebody got a beef with somebody? You know, or if there are allegations against a world leader and you got some evidence for it, well, let's go arrest them. Why do you have to bomb the country? You know, but
The highest strength, the person, a leader that has the patience, the wisdom, the leadership skills, they are going to use violence as the last resort. That is the weakest, to me, the most cowardly form of opposition to anything, you know, and as a resolution to anything. There are so many ways that you can approach and take a serious stand and stand strong and say, you know what, it's like when some of the people that were kidnapped, you know, okay, people were kidnapped and they said, no, we're not backing down. We're, you know, well, why? If we can be that strong against somebody that's kidnapped someone and is threatening you with their life, then why can't we be that strong before the war happens and say, no, you know, you are not going to draw us into your kind of debate. You are going to rise up and come to us in the way that we want to deal with things.
Mm-hmm.
And, it just seems like it takes strength, you know, and it takes control, and it takes tremendous leadership skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're out there somewhere.
Well, and a forum, too. We'd have to kind of take over CNN or a radio national format or something, because there are a lot of interests. It seems, anyway, like I'm not into the conspiracy theories per se. Some of America's most popular talk radio hosts, let's say, Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh, I mean, they don't want to hear any discussions about risks to soldiers' lives. You're being unpatriotic and you're not supporting the troops. There's not a lot of thinking in that. And I'm sure a lot of people could put Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly in their place, but they ain't going to let you get on their show to hear your thoughts on that subject, because look at how much money they're making. I mean,
reality is reality, and media sensationalizes reality. I mean, talk about distortion.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, you know, war... When you get to the bottom line, I agree with Kevin 100%. War is wrong. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing more to sensationalize. War is wrong. And when people wake up and realize that, killing somebody else because they don't think like you, because they don't act like you, because they don't understand you, that is not going to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I
would like to ask a question.
Sure.
Where is it honorable to teach 18-year-old men and women, young men and women, to be able to look through the sight of a rifle and to kill another human being 300 meters away? Why does that make them an honorable person? If we spend the time teaching our children not to settle their differences through violence, why don't we learn that lesson as adults and apply it in our lives as adults? And some people might say, well, you're oversimplifying the things because world affairs are not that simple, but why can't we just apply that to our everyday lives?
I know, that's a good point. You know, it also, you know, the same kind of teachings that we try to pass on to our children, like you say, are being forgotten for ourselves as adults. And I think about in the context of Iraq itself, you know, if you guys wanted, or I feel anyway, here's an idea. If you wanted to end the war immediately, all you'd have to do is, you know, outlaw torture, outlaw theft, return all the money that was taken from the Iraq Development Fund, because really, Bush has no right to touch any of those dollars, and yet he has. They've been writing contracts with American companies using Iraqi funds. It's not accountable. I mean, these corporations are charging themselves whatever. There's no oversight. All that money should be brought back, and if an American soldier was standing on the principles of the American flag or American freedom, it would be good for them, as you say, to look at the Iraqi people like American people. I mean, they're just people. We're all the people. The people.
Well, that's basically all they are. I met doctors. I met school teachers. I met engineers. I met construction workers. I met carpenters. They're no different than Americans. They're no different than Canadians. You guys all have your job to do.
Yeah.
We all have ours to do here. All they want is a house to live in and food to eat and to be left alone.
Bottom line is that you can talk all day about what one person did or what one person thinks and all, but until people stop talking and say, okay, this is where we want to get to, this is where we are, we've got to do this to move ahead. You know, close some of those forums for a while, stop some of the talk and just do the work that is going to make that happen. You know, and stop the war. Okay, well, guess what? Stop the war. Don't talk about it anymore. Just say we're not going to contribute to it. You know, take a stand and say we're not going to allow our money to go to it.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers say we're not going to fight this anymore. You know, people say we're not going to sit and wrap it anymore. We're going to stand up and do our best to try to make our country stronger, not to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, there could be, and most likely there are a lot of people out there, but as you were saying earlier, there, you need some form of leadership, but perhaps not. Perhaps more and more voices will grow, and it'll just take a life of its own. But it would be, you know, it would have been good if there were some outspoken critics of the war in America that we heard, that we could hear from time to time. You know, their ideas. Like the one thing that shocks me the most, although some people say I'm full of myself or whatever, and maybe I think too much. But the thing that I can't understand is just really why it isn't even being debated or discussed much in America. Like it is in the discussion groups, and I'm totally in agreement with you. There's a lot of in-house back and forth, and it seems, you know, hopefully there would be some progressive or there'd be something good about those discussions, you'd hope. But I mean, it doesn't seem to be much of any kind of, not that I'm watching American television all the time, but from the times that I do watch it, there's very little people just saying, like, let's support our troops by bringing them home. Let's help these Iraqi people by bringing back the money and outlawing torture. Like, I can't, like, this torture thing is really upsetting me, too. Like, I mean, okay, if we know that people are being tortured by people wearing American uniforms, I mean, we should arrest them, like, right now. And yet, they're not being arrested. Like, I know you guys probably aren't too much up on these things or in regards to the torture, but, I mean, we have people being tortured in Guantanamo Bay, and they're taxi cab drivers, dirt farmers. I mean, they're not connected to Al-Qaeda. They're not part of any terrorist insurgency, and yet some of them are being tortured to death. We know who the guy is. He wears an American uniform. It's Mr. Miller. I mean, under American law, just as you were saying earlier, Kevin, you know, you just think about it on normal terms. I mean, under American law, this guy would serve a life term prison sentence or he would be executed. That's under American law. But, oh, it's a special circumstance. He's got a special top secret presidential directive from Bush. Like, I don't understand that either. Like, I think American soldiers,
the people have to stand up and take charge.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you look at the way our Constitution is written, you're right. It's ultimately the responsibility of the people. And you say, when are we going to start doing something? And I ask that question, too, because it's not just people here. It's people all over the world that are suffering from apathy, and they have their head in the sand. It's time for them to stand up and say, look, this is enough. That's what I've done. I have stood up, and I said, I am not going to participate in war in any form from this day forward forever, the rest of my life, because I realize, after seeing the devastation of war and what it does to people, just how much of a waste that it really is. So not just the Iraq war, we need to eliminate all war. And we need to open up an intelligent dialogue, and we have to talk to people across the board, and we're going to have to solve these differences this way. We can't rely on the politicians, because too many people rely on politicians to solve their problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are waiting for that leader. Like you mentioned earlier, we have to have leaders. I think every person is perfectly capable of being their own leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every person is capable of knowing right from wrong, and every person has the opportunity to make that choice. And then it's up to them to look to what is in their life that they know is not in the best interest of their small world, and they need to change that. You know, they need to say, you know, there's somebody next door that needs some help. I haven't been helping them, but I'm going to start now. They need to say, you know, from this point on, if I see somebody that asks me a question and I don't really feel like I have the time, I'm going to give them the time anyway. And I think that if each person can lead themselves to do the best right thing and know in their heart that they're doing that, then pretty soon you won't have to worry about what the quote-unquote leaders are doing. Because with each person doing the right thing in their world, you know, it's going to make the right things happen in the big world. You know,
yeah.
And it's a matter of, you know, we all know what should and shouldn't be done, but nobody's really taking a stand to do their part in what should be done. It's, you know, they're just doing a lot of talking about what's been done, and it's been done wrong.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Kevin can say, I'm not going to fight in wars anymore. You know, I can say, I'm going to take care of the old people that I care about, and I'm going to do my very best for them, because that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you look to your children and you say, your very best job is to go to school, get an education, and use that education to provide good service to the world. And if each person did that for themselves and led themselves, we wouldn't have to worry about following leaders and whether or not they were telling us the truth and whether or not they were leading us into a good war, because there is no good war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if everybody were doing that, and it would take one person doing it at a time.
Yeah, well, and the bad leaders would be just, they'd be kicked out on their ass before they even walked in the door. People would say,
absolutely,
we're not buying that from you, actually.
Exactly.
We're stronger, wiser, and better equipped at defending ourselves. Thank you very much. Like the idea of Kevin being anything but a patriot, you know, is you know, I just can't believe anybody would call him a coward for taking a position that is obviously
probably wish they were seeing themselves in his
right. Family. Yeah, it's a position of strength that he's taken.
Exactly.
And it's true bravery, actually. There's a lot of reasons you could be afraid, but I wouldn't be. And I'm proud of what you're doing, as distant as I am and everything and whatever. There's all kinds of reasons to fear. But, I mean, your position is of a true patriot. Not only are you defending American soldiers, but you're also in that same way defending America by refusing to go along with this, essentially a charade. I mean, if Bush can give you a legitimate reason for being there, okay, well, maybe we have something to talk about. But I think one of the main reasons we're not getting much discussion in America is because Bush is just wrong. He's just wrong all over the place, man. Like, he's wrong even with pensions of the elderly and the Social Security. Man, I can't believe this Social Security situation. Like, who's he lying to there, man? You know, it's going to run for at least 40 more years. He says it. He tells everybody in America it's bankrupt, and CNN doesn't nail him to a cross on that. Like, what's going on? Yeah. But so there are a lot of other problems. But I see. You know, some people like being that I'm so outspoken against the war, and Kevin's a soldier. Although now he's come back. But even the people who are big soldiers, like I've talked to, like Rocky's a vet. He's a 35-year veteran, and he's killed all kinds of people. And we never got into any arguments or any fights or nothing. And yet I so vehemently oppose the position of the American government. And me and, you know, and I'm sure me and Kevin, we seem to be getting along okay. Like, I got no hostility against you guys. In fact, I'm rooting for you all the way. You know,
well,
so
that's where it has to start. I mean, it's going to take the average people in the world reaching across and offering their hand. Instead of reaching out to slap someone down, you have to reach out, and if that man has less than you, you have to try to give him a hand up.
Yeah.
And that's all it takes, is that one person, because the people come one at a time. You know, they come to you one at a time from no matter where. You know, they came to Kevin one at a time when he was in Iraq. He had youth in the neighborhoods came, and we would send care packages and give little treats and candy and shirts and things like that that he would give out to the kids that would help him. And each person there, and at the same time, they offered him something in return. And so you have that, and it is possible for that to happen. It happens in your neighborhood. You know, there's something that you can offer a person, and there's something that they can give you back. And if you could, if people can focus on that and realize, first and foremost, you know, life is one in the United States. It's our U.S. Constitution, and that, coupled with the Ten Commandments, are basically all you need to help you determine what the right thing is. And from that standpoint, look at that and say, you know, these are my actions. These are the opportunities that I have to take. These are the choices. Which road leads me towards what the Constitution and the Ten Commandments represent, and which road leads me the opposite direction? And, you know, then you make your choice which way you're going to go. And you know, in Kevin's instance, and I support him 100%, so I guess that makes it my instance too, that he chose the road leading towards defending the Constitution and what it stands for, and also relying on the Ten Commandments to guide him.
Yeah, exactly. Who can find fault with that? You know, the Ten Commandments, I mean, people could argue about that. But the Constitution, well, the Ten Commandments are good. I'm not, you know, I'm just saying, for argument's sake, there would be people who would. But for just the position, you know, thou shalt not kill, you know, we got an American Constitution here that says only Congress can declare war. So what's Bush doing? He's going in violation of the Constitution. But not only in that respect, also in the, you know, the persecution of innocent in these gulags or torture chambers. Mr. Bush is anti-American, you know. As I say, there's many people who almost rule the corporate news dictate in America who say anybody who criticizes him is an anti-American. I say Bush is anti-American,
well,
you know. And
I can't speak for Mr. Bush.
Right.
All I can is speak for myself. I can't speak for anyone else.
Right.
I can't speak for you. I can't speak for the people down the street. I can't speak for anyone else in the Army. I can speak for Kevin Benderman.
Okay.
And as a result of my experience, seeing combat firsthand and what it does to people and how it just destroys everything that is human about a person, I've come to the conclusion that we need to stop having wars, period. End of discussion. That's all you can say. Wars are an obsolete way and a form to handle your differences. We need to come up with a better way. And that reminds me, during the Christmas just passed, I was watching a special, and they were talking about German soldiers, and they were talking about American soldiers that were at the front lines, about 400 meters apart, I believe. And during Christmas, they each side heard the other one singing Christmas carols, so they all laid down their weapons, and they met each other in the middle, and they celebrated Christmas together. So if during World War II, soldiers can find it in themselves to be able to do that during a world war, why can't we do that for the rest of our lives, forever? Why can't we figure out how to not have war?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I'm thinking just as you said that, you know, people, like, again, we get those arguments where people would say you were being anti-American or you're siding with the traitor forces. But, I mean, it doesn't take much to see that a person who lives in Iraq feels that they're defending their nation, they're defending their family. People are, they're watching the indiscriminate murder of people in their cities. I mean, Fallujah was that was a big mistake, Fallujah was. But there, you can see that the Iraqi people have reasons to feel that it is in their right to protect themselves, to oppose this military force. Like, I mean, if an American was an Iraqi, would they not be there fighting the enemy? Of course they would. Most of them would, you know. Like, it's, I mean, like you say with the Germans and the Americans in World War II, although, well, you know, there are, I think even in today's context, they would even be closer, you'd think, perhaps. You know, so many of the same values that Iraqi people hold true are the same values that Americans hold true. I mean, spouses, men in general who wear uniforms are there to protect their families. I mean, the Iraqis are saying the same thing about themselves. I mean, like you say, how can we bring these two forces together? And I think, just as you say, I mean, if people could hear the calls of the Iraqi people, like what they're saying, what are the soldiers saying there? What are American soldiers saying? Why don't we have like a national dialogue on CNN or coast-to-coast radio network in America? I know it goes right across the United States of America. I mean, if somebody could just call Art Bell or one of the hosts there and say, hey, why don't we offer a couple of soldiers on here? Let's just have an open, honest debate and try to keep low with the hate and the bigotry and just try to work our way through this. Because you know what, Kevin? I think we'd be able to do it in no time flat. Like, it would just take us a couple hours, actually, figuring this out. Like, I mean, who would support this military action but for those that aren't informed? They don't understand what's going on. Like, people think, I've heard, polls that were made by Fox News or whatever, 85% of people who support Bush think Saddam played a part in 9/11. You know, like, Saddam's got nothing to do with 9/11, and yet there's even a testimony of a soldier who's in Iraq when asked why he's committing these acts of essentially murder. By the journalist asks him this, he says, well, I'm getting him back for 9/11. That's why he's killing these people. And you go, what's going on there? That's a complete failure of something.
Well, again, my point is not just this particular war, but it's all war. Humanity as a whole is going to have to figure out a way to solve their differences without war.
Yeah, well, if we're all of God, and it would be God's interest for us all to live in peace, and, you know, God is just, would want all people to be treated fairly, it would be in God's interest to ensure that all, you know, everybody kind of understands what's going on, like what the war is about, you know.
We're all, you know, when we say the Ten Commandments, you know, the Ten Commandments are in every faith. If people were to research it, they would find it in the universal faith. They would find it in Native American faith.
Yeah.
They would find it in so many places. And so, you know, we don't do this necessarily to relate it to God versus whatever.
Right, right.
The fact is, the issue is that people have the ability to find out the right information. You know, we did, plenty of people in America are, and they are trying to find the right information and trying to make the right things happen. Everybody has that opportunity and everybody has that potential. But going back and forth about, you know, it's like, okay, you can talk about the administration. Well, the administration is going to do what they're going to do. And it's up to the people to decide whether or not they support that. And, you know, and that's where that apathy, you know, each individual makes their choice. You know, and right now, Kevin's made his choice. I've made mine in following and supporting him, that this is the best that we can do. And then, you know, hopefully people will see what we're doing and what Kevin is doing, and hopefully they will say, you know, they will see the strength in that, and they will want to either follow suit or support us or, you know, I mean, but each person is going to have to make their choice.
Yeah, well, and like you say, like, I think those decisions would be godly. I mean, God, all religions would state God is just. And as,
right.
As you say, there are many similarities. Well, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhists, all those faiths, and many more. You know, they say, you know, treat your neighbor as yourself. You know, the Jewish faith is, don't do to someone else that you wouldn't want to be done to yourself. The mm-hmm. Buddhists have a similar saying, and so does just about everybody else. So it's all, you know, just treat everybody like it's a part of your family, and, you know, and have some concern for their lives as well as your own. And all religions say that, and everybody would agree with that. So again, it's this, if all people are of that same living force, that same God, let's say there's only one God, and, you know, we look at him or look at her or whatever in our own ways or whatever, but essentially it comes all down to the same principles, you know, that we want to treat each other with respect. And certainly,
and everybody deserves that same respect.
Yeah, well, most definitely. It shouldn't be, well, those are foreigners, so they're not really the people anymore, so we don't have to obey our own laws. Like, you know, like, I feel that that's part of the problem, too. Like, I mean, let's just stick to the American principles, the American Constitution, or the American Constitution, and the whole situation will resolve itself in Iraq particularly. I mean, you know, it's against the law to torture people. I'm sorry. We arrest you. It's against the law to steal people's money. I'm sorry. We arrest you, or the soldiers will get you. You know, the American soldiers will get the thieves in Iraq who are touching this Iraqi money. Like, and who would criticize them? They go, oh, you're being anti-American. No, I'm being a real American, actually. I'm not here to steal any money for Bush or anybody else. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But I'm not here to have somebody thieve in my name. I'm here to be my own person and defend these people as all people are, equals under rule of law and equals under God too. You know, all religions will try to teach that we should be thought of as equals, not one above the other, or some not accountable to a rule of law, which of course Mr. Bush has taken, or some would allege, you know, he's not necessarily accountable in this way or that way. And really, in America, he should be accountable just as every other real man is. You know, you can't make allegations against somebody and then murder members of their family and think you're going to get away with it, and everybody's just going to go, well, we just got to let him do it because he's the president. But that's my take on it, and I'm a little bit more aggressive in that respect. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for both of you. Who knows where this world is going, but I know what you guys are doing is the right thing for sure. I'm so pleased to see that you're getting as much coverage as you have so far, and hopefully that will keep up. You're true patriots. Don't let anybody else convince you otherwise. Thank you both so much for joining me on this program, and I hope and wish you all the best.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to present our views, and you have a good day.
That was John Canal in conversation with Sergeant Kevin Benderman and his wife Monica. Benderman has refused to return to Iraq, believing such war conduct is against his better principles. His refusal to return has invited a court-martial, and he remains steadfast in his belief that the war itself is un-American and unbecoming a man of faith. John Canal is the Earth's unofficial war correspondent. He is concerned with a unilateral world vision dominated by the whims and follies of the George W. Bush administration. We of this world freely welcome you to share this recording with friends and complete strangers, as all the rights have been reserved for us.